So I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this very nice meeting. And today I'd like to tell you about some topics in minimal string theory. So I can spend a lot of time telling you about what minimal string theory is from a variety of approaches, and I don't have time. So what I'll do instead is I'll take a very perhaps less common these days tour through the essentials of what's going on in order to unpack the results that I'm interested in. But I'll at some point try and refer to alternative perspectives so you can fill out the picture by going into the literature. So the interesting reason, the main reason I would say to do this sort of thing is to try and understand some of the things we're excited about in non-perturbative string theory. There are all sorts of interesting phenomena such as holography and tachyon condensation and open-closed dualities and geometric transitions which have shown up in, if you like, grown-up string theory. And one of the reasons I like minimal strings is because they give you toy examples of these things. They're toy laboratories. The other nice reason is that they are, in fact, some of the earliest models in which we got non-perturbative string physics out in the late 80s and early 90s. And it is amusing that we hadn't recognized just how much of this stuff was hiding in those models so early. So let's see what we can talk about, what we can learn from these models. So I'm going to talk about a number of things, some of which showed up in some very early papers I wrote with Simon Daly and Tim Morris. And there's another paper also with Anders Fattestam, which I'll talk about. And there's a recent paper, some of which will be discussed here. But the main result in terms of what's in the title really comes out of this new paper I wrote with James Carlisle, a graduating student at Durham, and Jeff Pennington, who's an undergraduate at USC. There's also appearing around the same time was a nice paper by Seiberg and Sieb, which in fact has a lot more of the space-time continuum physics picture, which complements some of the things we find in there. So the perspective I'm going to talk about today is from the point of view of string equations, which are the differential equations which are now known to encode the entire partition function of the string theories fully non-perturbatively. And I'll try and help you, just starting from this perspective, writing these equations down, extract some of the string theory from that. And you'll see it's sort of a fun thing to do. So let's start with this equation. So the content is as follows. U is some real function of a coordinate z. A primed will mean that I differentiate with respect to z, and there's a parameter nu, which I will tell you what it means in a while. And this curly r here is some combination of these things called r's, non-curly r's, label k, and all they are polynomials in u and its derivatives. And here's a few of them. And you can get them all by starting with R0 and using this recursion relation. So they're sometimes called the Gelfand-Dicke polynomials, and they have a long history in various areas of mathematical physics. So the TKs here are just some numbers, and that's just a normalization. And they'll turn out to be couplings in our string theory model in a while. So what you can actually do is you can pick out a particular model by setting all the t's to 0 except t0, which is z, which will turn out to be a bulk cosmological constant. And then the kth model, you can, without loss of generality, just scale that t to 1. Then that picks out a particular differential equation, which you can write down in closed form. And I'll give you an example in a moment. So the free energy of the theory, well, the full partition function, you can get by integrating up u twice with respect to z and setting it to mu. I just said the reverse of what I actually wrote here. Okay, so this, if you find a solution to this with the appropriate boundary conditions, it defines for you the partition function of the theory, and it turns out that you can actually get all of this from a matrix model, and I'll talk about that briefly in a moment. So here's the string equation, and let's actually see some of the string physics coming out. So an obvious family of solutions to this equation is just to set R itself to zero. So R is some combination of U and its derivatives, as I said. It's, in general, quite a large string equation, but an obvious family of solutions is just that. So if you actually look, for example, at the k equals 2, you'll see that R turns out to be this thing here, and then there's, this minus z would be the r, so r equals 0 is just, I've taken the z to the other side. For future reference, z and z are the same thing. Okay. No. What I'm going to do is show you how you can deduce things which you can interpret as a string theory. So if you were just someone who is interested in ordinary differential equations, I'm taking that route. Okay. But as you know, there's many other ways to this, but time does not. So I can just start solving this. I look for solutions for u as a function of z. So what I can first do is solve this thing perturbatively in the regime where z is large and positive. And so you can just expand this solution and you'll get something looking like this. So, well, that's sort of interesting. What happens then, follow what I said before, which is integrate up twice and throw in the appropriate factor of nu in the right places. And what you find is that this thing assembles itself into a nice series where I've integrated up, z becomes that thing called mu, and then I've gathered up all the places where I have that other factor nu, I get a series like this. And what you begin to recognize is that you have string perturbation theory as if G subscript S is in fact G string. If you go through and you do dimensional analysis on all of the various parameters that appear in this equation, you'll find that this is indeed dimensionless, and it is indeed a dimensionless coupling, and that's G to the zero, the torus, etc. And so you might be convinced then that this might be something to do with the string theory. And in fact, historically, this equation, Panleve 1, was the equation that was found by those three groups, Douglas and Schenker, Brezin, Kazakov, Gross and McDowell, when they first took the double scaling limit of various matrix models and realized that those were C equals zero string theories. This is what they wrote down. So there's an underlying matrix model. I will talk about a matrix model in a while. And so what they were looking at was this R equals zero sector. And let's carry on. You might actually then start looking to see what U looks like in the entire Z dependence. And what I showed you just now was the large positive Z dependence. It's going like z to the half, as I said. So that was nice. We've encoded the complete perturbation theory of a string theory, and also their operator insertions, which you can get by switching on all of the other t's. So in the schematically, that looks like I switch on some operators proportional to the tk's. And one of the things they realized at the time, those various groups, was that as a function of the t's, switching on all the other t's, which are operator insertions from the point of view of the string theory, these things evolve according to the generalized KdV hierarchy, a famous family of soliton equations. So du dt is some polynomial of u and its derivatives, the classic example being the original equation of KdV describing solitons. The KdV flows then organize the flows between the models, moving between the various models. Another way of thinking about it is that they're simply operator insertions controlling the TKs, control various operator insertions. What are the models? These are actually the 2K minus 1, comma 2 conformal minimal models coupled to Liouville theory. It's one of the reasons why minimal string theory gets its name. Minimal string theory. So I can talk about, just as just notation, I can define my operator correlation functions to be DFDTKs, remembering that U was second derivative of F with respect to T0. I also have it as being thought of as a two-point function of some important operator, which is often called the puncture operator. Anyway, there's a lot to be said here, so I'll sort of move on and try and get to some of the other things. But there are approaches whereby you can talk about the underlying integrable structure. The KdV system is an integrable system, and you can actually use as your starting point that the KdV hierarchy gives you these relationships between operator insertions, and come up with another way of expressing the content of these models. And here's an interesting example. If I write the string equation down, this is what I called R equals 0 before. I've just taken that Z to the other side. Take a derivative of it, and then... I take a derivative of it, and then just massage things a little bit using the relationships I wrote before, but essentially just taking U out and replacing it by F, and write it as a constraint on the partition function by using the exponential relationship between F and Z. I get something which is called the first of a family of constraints, which are called the Virasoro constraints. I get this from the string equation, and then the various recursion relations of KdV give me a whole family of them, which satisfy a Virasoro algebra and called the Virasoro constraints. And it's sort of interesting. There's an interesting history there. This is one of the ways in which people found correspondences between various important topological string theories, which are nicely expressed in this language. That's another story. That's the rest of the Virasoro constraints. Anyway, in view of the time, I won't go too much into this except to say that this is the nicest way to check that you really are working in the models that you think you're working in the sense that these can be written in terms of these derivatives, of course, are also operator expectation values. And so these turn out to be a family of recursion relations for the operators OK. And while formally it looks like you have an infinite number of them because there's an infinite number of these TKs in the way I wrote things down, it turns out that these recursion relations tell you you only have K minus one of them, which is what you should have for the Liouville-dressed content of the minimal models that you've coupled to build the string theory. Okay, so this is still all history. Let me say a little bit about the matrix model perspective. So you write down a matrix model for some matrix M, for example, some N by N Hermitian matrix model, and you have some polynomial potential in M with some couplings G, and you get the minimal string after the double scaling limit, which I'll henceforth refer to as DSL. And what actually happens, so as not to go into too much detail again, I'll just schematically say what the double scaling limit is, which is that you take N large while scaling these couplings to various critical values in order to extract universal physics. So you've seen this sort of thing today before. It's nice to work in terms of the eigenvalues of the matrix, and so I can go to a nice diagonal basis using a matrix U, there's a van der Mond determinant which pops out as the Jacobian for doing that change of variables. And the picture you have in mind, or should have in mind, in this language is that there's some potential V, and then the eigenvalues form some sort of droplet, which, so there's lambda, the coordinate representing the eigenvalues, at large n, these things form a continuum, and a droplet of some size. They're trying to repel each other, but there's also a confining potential, the potential of the model itself, and so they form a nice droplet, which you can then move that droplet around by changing the couplings defining this V, that V being the thing I wrote previously, couplings little g. What actually happens is that the universal physics occurs when this when you tune this V such that this droplet is about to spill out to a new minimum, because this, if you like, this maximum here has dropped down to a point where they would then jump out. That's where the critical physics comes from, and it's useful to work entirely in the eigenvalue space at that point, focusing only on the regime where that universal physics is coming from, which is the endpoint of the eigenvalue distribution where it's just about to spill out. And geometrically, that's what the double scaling limit's doing for you. It's focusing on the tail of the distribution near the critical region. So there's an interesting thing you can do once you've arrived at this picture, which is you can actually study the physics of one of these eigenvalues and what it wants to do in this particular situation. And so one way of working is to compute the effective potential for one of these eigenvalues at some order in perturbation theory. Let's work at the sphere for now. And it looks like this. So what do I have here? I've now called lambda S, meaning I'm working in the scaling region near the end of the eigenvalue distribution, as I said before. And now this is the effective potential. So what actually turns out is that the eigenvalue distribution comes in from infinity and ends at some point. And it turns out that for the kth model, it ends on the sphere at the position mu to the 1 over k. And the effective potential either looks like this, going off indefinitely to the left, or it rises and then drops. And the difference is that that's for the odd k models and the even k models. So what actually, I'll return to that picture shortly. What actually happens when you try and find the real function representing the full extension of u in this into all of z space, you find that you end up with a family of poles. The model does not have a nice smooth u, and hence a nice partition function. And this is one way of seeing the famous instability that people refer to when they talk about the original matrix models. And it turns out that this is just for k equals 2, but this is generically the case for the even models. This matches the picture that I drew earlier. What actually is happening is that there's some instability coming from the fact that these eigenvalues can tunnel out of the model for the k even case. So in the modern language, we re-examine this picture, starting with some of the discussions of McGreevy and Valinda, and several other authors then move that picture on. And there's a lot that can be learned about this picture and some of the other things we want to understand better in grown-up string theory, such as tachyon condensation. And so I'll try and say a little bit about that now. So let's focus on this picture here, where I now, this is the k-even models, and I have the eigenvalue distribution here, and I have some potential, and then I have, as I said, this is the effective potential for one of these eigenvalues. So the picture, I've forgotten what I actually said. Ah, yes, that's what I said. So the picture that you you have, actually, this is this goes back to the old picture as well from Schenker's discussions. You can actually compute the action of one of these eigenvalues, which is, of course, the height of this potential. And so you can actually compute that, the effective at the maximum there. And it turns out for the kth model that that's where it takes place. You actually compute it and notice that it goes like 1 over g string. And this, of course, was one of the... This was one of the early signs, as pointed out by Schenker, that non-perturbative effects in string theory should go in this interesting way with the string coupling. And if you like, this is a precursor with D-brains, precursor of D-brains. What people do now is they go back and say, this is not just a sign of D-brains. These really are the D-brains of the string theory, of the minimal string theory. And so I'll say a little bit more about what the nature of that D-brain is shortly. And one of the things we'll do later in the talk with the new results is talk about how to actually put several of these types of D-brains in as a background. And
is there an
erotic
version of this?
Gosh. Not anywhere in the literature as far as I'm aware. Yeah, that's all I can say. I'd like to actually just trying to think. Okay. Let me move on. I'd like another to take another detour to come up with another perspective on how to capture some of the physics here. So I showed you at the beginning string equations giving the non-perturbative physics of U, which you then integrate out to get the partition function of some string theory, supposedly. And I also showed you the eigenvalue space of the original, of the double-scaled matrix model. And you might ask what the connection between these things might be. There's a link there to be made. Again, this is known from the old literature. So it turns out that there's a nice operator telling you about the scaled eigenvalue position. And this guy, if you look at it, looks like this. It's called Q in the literature a lot. And there's another way of formulating the KdV hierarchy in terms of fractional powers of this guy. We're not going to go in that direction. What I'm going to do instead is talk about the eigenvalue problem associated with this Hamiltonian. So what you should think of is that there is this Hamiltonian where U supplies the potential for this Hamiltonian in one dimension, and then essentially the eigenvalues lambda are the spectrum of that particular model. So that's a nice way of linking up the spectrum, and from the pictures I drew before, you can see that a continuous spectrum bounded from below is what you would expect for a sensible model, and that's where the even models fail in defining sensible non-perturbative physics. Perturbatively, they're fine. Non-perturbatively, you find that there are these instanton effects which destroy.
Even models mean an odd potential?
The reason I hesitate is because you can tune a lot of things. It's not before and after double scaling. A lot of junk gets lost when you take the double scaling limit. So to say what the order of the potential is before double scaling doesn't necessarily connect to what the value of k is. So, for example, I can get k equals 2 by starting with either a cubic potential or a quartic potential or a... Just how many of the original undouble-scaled couplings do I tune to get to a particular critical point? Basically, the thing... k just tells you what the nature of the critical point is in some coupling space in the un-double scaled potential. And it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the order of the potential. Does that help? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So what's the modern picture? So I've sprinkled a bunch of facts from the old language for you. And now what I want to do is line this up with the language that that we all speak in modern times. And so the point is that it's a little bit like ADS-CFT, or from some perspectives, it's a lot like ADS-CFT. What you have is some non-critical string theory in the sense of it's not your normal critical strings, but it's still a string theory. And there are D brains. Therefore, are, for example, D0 brains. And you can actually go and work out the details of those D0 brains in that Liouville theory, in the Liouville theory, conformal field theory coupled to Liouville theory. And so the famous set of papers that do that are these first four initials here, for they have Samolodikov, Samolodikov, and Teschner. And so you work up the details of those. You take n of, so now McGreevy and Valinda tell you, take n of these guys, write down the whirl volume theory of the open string modes as we would in any gauge gravity type setup. And that's what we're supposed to believe the original matrix model actually is. And then holography then is recovering the full string theory. And you extract out the full string theory, all the universal physics looking at the double scaling limit. So the earlier picture that I drew is in fact another thing we'd like to understand better, which is tachyon condensation. The tachyon condensation picture works like this, as presented by Sen. There's some open string sector which has some tachyon, which you could write a potential for, and then I can condense those tachyons, I can roll down, I can start up here, and then roll down to some new minimum, which is supposed to correspond to the closed string physics. And there's a lot of difficulty in making this picture work in various grown-up string theories. What is the actual description? Once the open strings have shown you where to go, they want to decay away and then disappear and leave you with the closed string description. Exactly how do you get a grip with the right variables? The matrix model realization tells you in very precise terms a nice example of this, in the sense that the tachyon potential is in fact the potential I was talking about before, this V of lambda S. And what I actually have then at the top of the potential is that instanton, that tunneling guy from before, in the previous example, and generically, it's some open string sector. It's a D brain which lives at the top of the potential. It rolls down, and it rejoins those eigenvalues that live down there, the fluctuations of which correspond to the usual closed string physics. And so the matrix model tells you precisely how this whole picture works and gives you a nice realization of how this is supposed to work in general in grown-up string theories. And so that's a nice thing, and you can actually go ahead and compute the value of this potential, and you can characterize the fluctuations of these of the closed string fluctuations are just the fluctuations of the eigenvalues, but those are just the insertions of those TK operators corresponding to closed string insertions to closed string operators. So that's rather nice. But what we actually would like to do also is, of course, get a grip of the non-perturbative physics. And so now we need to go beyond what I talked about before.
Actually, can I ask a very naive question about your last slide?
Mm-hmm.
As I understood it, the matrix model equals a string theory only at its critical points, only at points where it has a phase transition. Is that right, or is this holography somehow more general?
I would say it the other way around, which is that I have some matrix model, and what I would say is best understood is the critical points of the matrix model where you extract universal physics that you call string physics. And there is the string theory. And that I, whether to say I, whether I should say that for all n and for all couplings in the in an arbitrary matrix model, I should call that holographic as well. I it would be nice, but I don't know. That certainly has not been tested. But what I'm talking about is the place where we know the matrix model on the one hand at its critical point at large n, and can read off things that we can reliably compute and compare to a continuum string theory. And there, I think both sides are well understood. But there may be something more general to be understood, yes. But I have nothing intelligent to say about that. Okay, so so that was sort of history, and this is kind of a little bit of history as well. Can one do better on the non-perturbative side? Remember, the K even models were sick, and the answer is yes. And in fact, it was done a long time ago. What we need to do now is go back and dig in the history update that a little bit. So the equation we began with was this larger equation. R equals zero. What we looked at so far is R equals zero with this asymptotic. You went like z to the in general 1/k for z large. And those sorts of solutions which solve R equals zero are the things that were originally found by the original double scaling limit papers. What we pointed out way back then, shortly after the double scaling limit papers, was that you can do more than that. You can actually have solutions of this equation which do not restrict to R equals zero, but solve the whole equation. And those have the same large Z asymptotics as the usual guys, and so match on to the usual string perturbation theory that we like from the continuum string physics. So everything's happy in that regime. But in the other regime, this function goes to zero as z goes to minus infinity. And so, I already said that. And so this is new. This is a new regime, and it gives you a whole bunch of new solutions to study. The question is whether those solutions can be interpreted appropriately. So there are two perturbative regimes now. There's that regime, and there's a nice regime which goes like that. The solutions, I should just emphasize again, no longer solve the equations that were originally proposed to define non-perturbative string theory. They solve that larger equation. And the nice thing is that you just don't wake up and make up that equation. It also comes from a matrix model. There are various ways of seeing what kind of matrix model it comes from. One sort of matrix model you can get it from is by writing a complex matrix model. Which I've called M again. And the natural potential is written in terms of M dagger M. And the natural eigenvalues to discuss are now the eigenvalues of M dagger M, which are positive. If you think about that, all that does, it's rather like the original Hermitian matrix model problem, looking at the eigenvalue picture, except that now the eigenvalues are restricted to lie on the positive real line. So it's very quick to see why this model does not suffer from the instability problems of the previous models, and that's simply because there is no abyss for them to tunnel to. There is no abyss for them to tunnel to because the eigenvalues can only live on the positive part of the space. So if you like, there's a that side of the wall doesn't exist. That side of the system does not exist. So what have I drawn here? What I've drawn here then is, in fact, what we had before. Locally, the eigenvalue distributions look just like the ones for the Hermitian matrix model, except that now you can only go from zero to infinity. And so the actual instanton of interest is the one which lives there at zero, and similarly in the case for k even. And so there's sort of an interesting universal instanton that lives at the wall, which deserves to be interpreted as a D-brain as well. Well, I'll come back to that. What you might actually prefer, given modern discussions, is to work in the covering space where I simply open up that half line and put its mirror image on the other side. And then you recognize a picture that people are discussing in modern times a lot, which is that when you talk about the type zero string theories coming from matrix models, you actually have an inverted potential where you filled up the eigenvalue of C on both sides of the potential. And so that's, in fact, the picture that we have here, which comes out of, in this case, a complex matrix model. And in a minute, I'll tell you that the bosonic string theory, space-time bosonic string theory that this physics all pertains to is, in fact, type 0A. And so that's why I have a tau type 0A. This would, in fact, be the brain of a type of a 0A string theory. So there's something else I wanted to point out here, which is that there's a natural picture here in terms of interpreting what, remember I said there were two regimes now, positive mu and negative mu. What is the difference between the two in this picture? You can see what happens. For positive mu, the eigenvalue distribution pulls away from the wall. So that mu sets how far up I filled the Fermi C, if you like, in the usual language. But the point is I can overfill the Fermi C when I have both sides filled up. And that gives me what I would identify as the negative mu regime in these variables. And so this is something which is now well understood from the work of various people in the continuum string theory, that there's a natural positive and negative understanding of mu in this double-filled perspective. Okay, so here again I have something interesting that's going on, which is that when I have positive mu, as I said, I've filled up to some value below the top of the potential, and so I have closed string physics representing the ripples of this C, but I can also have open string physics where I pull an eigenvalue out and do things up here. But when I'm in the negative mu regime where I filled up the eigenvalue C completely and I've lost the potential underneath the C, I only have closed string physics. I can no longer raise an eigenvalue up to the top of some potential. So this is going to be nice because this is going to turn out to give us examples of physics that where we compute at some mu, and for large positive mu, we have open string physics that'll turn out in what we're going to discuss to be background D-brains. And then we just follow the physics to large negative mu. We get another perturbative regime. We no longer have D-brains, but we still have the RR sector excited, and that's because we have fluxes. And so this is going to be a nice example of geometric transitions, open-closed dualities, that, again, we like from grown-up string theory. So let me now explain how I put in these background brains. How do I actually, now, rather than have the closed string physics and the possibility of seeing the brains as instantons, as tunneling excitations, I can actually prepare backgrounds where I have some fixed number of background brains sitting in the model. And there's a string equation for that. And again, in fact, it was discovered a long time ago. It's in fact the string equation we had just now. We simply stick a constant on the end. You don't do that arbitrarily. You can derive it from a matrix model again. I don't have time to show you just yet the details of that. So this is remarkably simple. So again, from the point of view of differential equations, I could just say I have this nice ordinary differential equation now with this constant on the side, and I can expand this thing just as before and see what it does. And if I do exactly what I did before, it turns out that in the expansion, this is the large Z expansion, I start getting some extra terms corresponding to this being non-zero. And if you actually look at it, you'll see that it's again string perturbation theory, but now I have the possibility not just of handles but boundaries, and I have a factor of gamma for every boundary. And of course in modern terms you say, oh, that's just I've stuck in some number of D-brains. Okay, and so this is really inserting extra D-brains into the theory, and as we'll see, this allows you to study some amusing physics in modern terms. So yeah, it is amusing that all of this was around in 1992 or whenever we did this. And now the picture we had at the time, what we were doing is what we had presented was with this as zero, we thought this was the this was just giving you an alternative set of non-perturbative physics for the bosonic strings. Now with the work of Klebanov, Maldacena, and Seiberg, we know that really what you should be thinking about is not the bosonic strings, but the type 0A strings. And then we thought we were putting brains in those bosonic strings. We didn't call them brains at the time. We called them open string sectors. But now we see what they actually are brains in type 0A string theory, thanks to the work of Klebanov, Maldacena, and Seiberg, who basically went back to our papers and interpreted it in modern terms. But all of the actual physics, forgetting what everything's called, the actual physics is explicit. So there's the sphere, there's the disk, there's the cylinder next to the torus, etc. Okay, so just very briefly, I can tell you one way of thinking about how you've put in the extra brains is to think of it as a rectangular matrix model. M, instead of being n by n, is m n by n plus gamma. And if you follow it through, you'll find, let me move on a little bit. You'll find that the way of thinking about this, as you know from modern times, is that I have simply n d-brains, which is the, if you like, the d-brain from which the gauge theory comes, and then the gamma extra ones, which are these off-diagonal guys, which are the flavors coming from adding extra brains. So that all fits nicely. So now I want to talk about the other regime, the fact that I have this nice, I can expand the equation in positive z or mu or negative mu. So I gave you the positive mu expansion before. Here's the negative mu expansion. And so we had written expansions like this back in 1993 for this other regime, this unknown perturbative regime, which we didn't know how to interpret. One thing that's interesting is that there are all sorts of accidental, interesting zeros which show up, and you can prove all sorts of amusing things, but we didn't know what all that meant. One interesting thing you might notice is that only even powers of gamma appear in this negative mu regime. And this is where KMS came in and actually pointed out that this fits nicely. It's a type 0A minimal string. And what it actually is the 4K, 2 superconformal minimal models coupled to super Liouville with a GSO projection that gives you 0A. So this is the nice thing. The strange regime, this negative mu regime, just turns out to be closed string theory with gamma measuring how many units of RR flux that you have. There's some Ramond-Ramond field in the continuum model, and gamma measures its charge. So now the picture is nice. You have from the positive mu regime, you can stick in that parameter gamma, and that counts the number of d-brains. And in the negative mu regime, we now understand that just counts Ramond-Ramond flux. So I can compute something at some value of mu, and depending upon how what the value of mu is, I interpret it either as in the positive mu perturbative regime, it has brains. In the negative mu perturbative regime, it has fluxes. And this is precisely what we'd like to call a geometric transition. So that's sort of interesting, and there's all sorts of things you can do with that. And one thing I'd like to talk about in the last 15 minutes is the string equation itself. So the string equation, as I wrote down before, I'll write it down again, seems to be happy with any value of gamma, irrespective of where that string equation came from for a minute. It's a well-defined equation. And one of the things you might ask is, how does the string equation know that positive integer versions of gamma are special, counting some number of brains or units of flux? And it isn't at all obvious that's built into the equation. Another way of asking the question, it turns out, is to ask whether this whole D-brain flux story cares about the underlying integrable structure or not. And in fact, I could actually just start with the KdV hierarchy with one very natural condition, which is scale invariance, and write down the string equation without reference to any matrix model at all. And so it would be nice to know if the string equation thus arrived at already can pick out the special values of gamma without having to worry about a matrix model definition where gamma is kind of integer by virtue of being the size of a matrix. So in view of the time, maybe I should skip this. Okay. Well, it's here now. One of the interesting things, this is sort of a parenthetical remark, but kind of amusing. One of the interesting things you can do is, remember those Virasoro constraints I told you about from the way of writing it, that was due to Dijkgraaf, Valinder, and Valinder back in 1991. One of the things you can do once you realize that gamma represents some open string sectors is you can actually see what happens to the Virasoro constraints, and after some work you can derive this form. At this point I was going to babble about coherent states and twisted bosons. Let me not do that. Cute things happen. Let's move on to studying the fully non-perturbative physics of that string equation. So as I said before, this is some ordinary differential equation. It's highly nonlinear, very hard to analyze. And so what you can actually do is show that the thing has the right behavior, show that the kind of solutions you want exist by working numerically. So there's that large positive z regime where it goes like z to the half, and there's the regime where it goes like zero. So that's brains in that direction, fluxes in that direction, and then fully non-perturbative stuff elsewhere. That blue line is the case of purely gamma equals zero, so purely closed string physics with no background brains, and then these are positive gammas switched on. So one interesting thing you get to do, remembering that U supplies the potential for some associated Hamiltonian problem, is check that the spectrum of this thing is continuous and bounded from below. And you might be a little bit concerned that this well might start bringing you in bound states. So this is some of the things that we started out trying to understand recently. And we also wanted to explore negative values of gamma. So what actually happens is that if you start looking at negative values of gamma, so now this is just from the perspective of what does the string equation tell us, forgetting about where it came from, the well gets deeper. I'll plot some of that in a minute. And one of the things we began to realize was that something funny was happening at gamma equals minus 1 numerically, and we were wondering whether that was actually also telling us that there's some interesting physics there. So the question we were asking at every stage also was, what is the spectrum, the fully non-perturbative spectrum of the model in terms of whether or not there are any bound states in particular of the associated Hamiltonian? And so the interesting thing is, as I said, the well's getting deeper, and you might worry that some bound states might form. So I should have some pictures. There we go. So the yellow line is gamma equals zero. And then I start going negative in gamma, and you can see the well getting deeper. Here's just a few random values of gamma. So before we go on, it's interesting to note that you can actually do some analytical work which will be useful in a moment. So we actually went back and looked in this old paper I wrote with those other authors and realized that there's a natural map. It was realized there that there was a natural map, and it was talked about implicitly in that paper. If you have U at some gamma, you can actually get to U of gamma plus or minus 1 by a map. And what I was able to do was make sense of this map, and you can actually go ahead and explicitly derive a formula for it. So I need to explain what this means. So curly R here refers to R, that family of that combination of U and its derivatives, and it refers to U at gamma. So I have some solution U at some value of gamma, and I build this horrible thing, and that actually gives me U at gamma plus or minus 1, depending upon the sign there. So that's highly non-trivial, and I'll explain why this is a very amusing formula in a moment. But from the point of view of the problem we're trying to understand, this is really useful for the following reasons. So as I said before, we were having some difficulty numerically trying to get to U gamma equals minus 1. The well gets deeper in the previous picture, as I was saying, the well gets a lot deeper and narrower, and the numerics just starts getting a little bit uncomfortable. The really nice thing you can do is use this relation to get very close to gamma equals minus 1. And the way you do that is that you have control over U in the vicinity of 0, where gamma equals 0. And so what you can do is work with gamma being epsilon, some small number, and then use that map to study gamma equals minus 1 plus epsilon, and then send epsilon to 0 at will. And so what we notice is that something interesting happens. So we're able then to map out much more of the solution by combining that analytic result with the numerical result. So what actually happens is that, so there's U equals 0, gamma equals 0 case, and then this is successively more and more negative gamma going towards gamma equals minus 1. And the amusing thing, what's happening is that this is numerical accuracy being lost up here. They all asymptote. Actually, this is the case k equals 1 here for simplicity. They all asymptote to u equals z that way and 0 that way. And this well gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And that, as I said before, gives you some cause for concern. You might worry that non-perturbatively there's going to be an instability because the associated Hamiltonian will develop some bound states. This well's getting very, very deep. And what actually happens, though, is that the solution arranges itself so that as the well gets deeper, it also gets narrower in a way that squeezes out any bound states from appearing. And so you can actually do that by estimating, for example, the quadratic approximation to the well, compare the height of the well to the curvature, and read off what the simplest harmonic oscillator state would be. And you see that it manages to survive as the well gets arbitrarily deep towards the right. Anyway, here's something we noticed numerically, and this is very interesting. I'll try and show you in the next two slides. as you follow, if you look actually at the function, so there's the function gamma equals zero, and then these are successively more and more negative gamma going towards minus one. As you can see, what's happening is that away from the well here, to the left of the well, they all seem to be falling on the same line before then they dip down to the well, and then the well gets narrower and deeper off to infinity as gamma approaches minus one. The interesting thing is that they all seem to be approaching a somewhat universal curve, which looks like that. And so just eyeballing it, you actually realize that this universal curve is the gamma equals plus one case. So this, what I've plotted here is the function u for gamma equals plus one. And what I had previously was the guys getting closer and closer to minus one. So for example, if I look at this blue, this light blue curve here, it falls exactly on the gamma equals plus one curve for a long way and then dips down and then comes back up. And that dip happens further and further off to infinity as gamma gets closer to minus one, and it's narrower and narrower. So the difference between this function and the gamma equals plus one case gets more and more negligible for more and more of the left of that well, which itself is going off to infinity. Okay, so I said that rather clumsily, but I think you get the idea. That's highly suggestive that in fact the case gamma equals minus one is just the case gamma equals plus one, and somehow the equation knows about this and is trying to tell us that by this interesting structure of its solutions. So what must be happening is that the well must narrow away more and more as it moves off to infinity, leaving just the gamma equals plus one curve. So it's actually really, once you realize that, incredibly trivial to prove that from this relation, which is that I can just do what I said, but work with the case gamma equals zero curve. So I simply put in u for the gamma equals zero case, and then go either up or down using this relation. And the point is that there's a gamma in front of the plus or minus one term, so the solution simply can't tell, the system simply can't tell the difference between u for gamma equals minus one and u for gamma equals plus one. They're the same, identically, and that's what the equation was trying to tell us. So what's the meaning of all of this? Sort of combination of analytic and numerical work. Well, what it does is that it picks out the natural values of gamma being the positive integers. It doesn't rule out absolutely that there's interesting physics for non-positive, non-integer gamma, but there's something very special about the integers. So first of all, the integers are all related to each other by this transformation. I start with some gamma, I can change it by an integer. And then the case gamma equals minus one actually just pops us back to gamma equals plus one. So that sort of puts a natural bottom on the ladder of available gammas. Okay, and for all of those, the fully non-perturbatively, the spectrum is continuous and bounded from below, which is nice. So non-perturbatively, all these models are completely sensible non-perturbatively. And then one interesting thing is that any non-integer value of gamma is connected to cases that has poles using this transformation. So for example, if I started with gamma equals plus a half, I can then get to gamma equals minus a half. And then what you can actually notice, I'll just go back and show you that, is that this transformation will then pick up poles for any cases where gamma is less than minus one, because this denominator goes to zero at some point. So I don't have time to tell you about that, but that's what happens. And so it's very natural that the integer cases of gamma, the positive integer cases of gamma, are picked out by the equation. So that's really nice, just in case you've completely lost the thread of what I'm talking about. The string equation itself, without any reference to the continuum string theory that it's supposed to be dual to or what have you, actually knows that positive integer values of that constant are very special. And that's sort of very nice and satisfying. And for those values, the spectrum is really well behaved, and everybody's happy. So let me finish with an observation. There's Baekeland transformations in the title. What does that refer to? So if you're an integral model person, you get very excited about Baekeland transformations, or if you're somebody who solves differential equations in general, because they're very useful for finding new solutions. Okay, and let me rewrite things slightly differently. I can work, instead of the differential equation, I can work with its first derivative, which turns out to be nice and simple, looks like that. Okay, and then it turns out that U of gamma going to U of gamma plus or minus 1 is a map between solutions of the same equation. I work with the differentiated equation here because then there's no explicit appearance of gamma. It only appears in the boundary conditions on U. So that's what a Baekeland transformation is. You have some solution of an equation, and then there's some transformation which can generate you a new solution for free. And the famous ones are the KdV Baekeland transformations. And what those do is they tell you how many solitons you have. You can start with one soliton, kick it with a Baekeland transformation, and derive the solution with two solitons, three solitons, etc. And so one of the things we realized is that this solution, this particular transformation that we've been working with, is in fact the KdV Baekeland transformation itself in disguise. So that's sort of amusing, because gamma, of course, counts for us the number of background brains or units of Ramond-Ramond flux. And so this is really very nice, because it's telling us that the Baekeland transformations do indeed act on the D-brains, and tell us that, I'm just babbling here, there we go. D-brains, in some sense, are, we know they're solitons for so many reasons, but now here's another reason why they're solitons. They're a special class of soliton, this is a little bit more formal though, solitons of the KdV hierarchy, in the sense that I can change the number of them by acting with the KdV hierarchy's Baekeland transformations. And so that's sort of rather nice, and we'd like to work more on that, because purely from a mathematical physics point of view, there's a number of interesting things to be learned here. First of all, I've just shown you that I can just write down a string equation without reference to any underlying continuum string theory. And the string equation actually knows many of the properties of the things we would call D-brains and what have you in the string theory without us having to impose that by intuition from the other string theory. And of course, from the dual string theory. And of course, the point is that the KdV hierarchy is just one of a large family of interesting integrable systems, which all might relate to interesting string theories from which we might learn things. And we might not have matrix model realizations for all of those. So this is sort of an interesting story in the sense that it might be that we can go some way to learning things about toy string theories without necessarily having a matrix model. And so some of the things that exist in the integrable literature, some of the powerful tools such as Baekeland transformations, naturally do things to the physical things that we like D-brains and Ramond-Ramond fluxes. So that's one of the lessons to be learned from this story. And it would be interesting to go ahead and just follow one's nose and start writing down candidate string theories with just these few clues, and seeing how far one can go to learning interesting examples of all of the phenomena such as Takan condensation and geometric transitions, etc., without necessarily having a matrix model. Anyway, so given the fact that I've repeated myself several times in this last slide, it's probably a good point to stop. Good, that means that it was perfectly clear and no questions. Oh, okay.
I was just wondering about the last thing you said there. Would you be hoping then that you could find, if you wanted to do this for some other integral hierarchy, that you could find cases of your equation that are related to some other well-known soliton equation?
For example, yes. So there are other integral hierarchies. So, for example, the type 0b system, is known due to the work of KMS and others to relate to the Zakharov-Shabbat hierarchy, which is well known in the integrable literature, relates to nonlinear Schrodinger equation and things like that. And there's a rich family of physics there. People spend their entire careers studying solutions of the associated equations to those and deriving things like Bacon transformations, etc. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of that technology can also be translated with the appropriate care and mindful of the lessons we've learned here to lessons about a continuum, a dual continuum string theory with various kinds of background fields or brains switched on. Given that we have no broad principles for doing anything in string theory, it's just one gathers examples where one can. And this seems to be a rich area for perhaps getting some interesting new examples.